Hi, my name's Martin Poole. I think dyslexia is more fun than scrubby. How do we? Scrubby, Conrad's toy. Okay, lovely. All right. So, to start with, I'm happy to take questions either as we go along or at the end. Just kind of wave your hand around. I wanted to talk to you today about a little open source project I've been working on called dysCC, which is a system for spreading the work of compiling software across several machines on the network. I started thinking about it after Trij's ckache program was released earlier in the year. We had a couple of machines at work which were just sitting there not doing very much, and it seemed like kind of a waste. So I was wondering what we could do to load them up a bit. We could put on distributed net, but it doesn't really achieve anything much. We do spend a lot of time in the print server appliance project that I work on at HP building large software trees like Samba or Linux or things like that. And we might have installed something like MOSIX or one of the various Linux clustering packages, but they're pretty intrusive. You need to install a kernel patch, and the machines get pretty tightly coupled together. So it seems like a lot of work. So I was wondering if there was a simpler system that we could use for clustering for this one particular task. And based on ckache, I thought of something. And that was my other motivation for making sure that it would work pretty well. Trij was skeptical about it. I did a bit of research on the web on what you can do to use three or four or more machines to build software faster. It's a problem a few people have looked at. Maybe people in the audience have had a shot at it themselves. We can build upon the fact that GNU Make knows how to run several jobs in parallel and spread out the load across machines that way. The obvious way, perhaps, is to just use RSH or SSH to move the command to another machine. It's pretty straightforward. Sun, the Make system that Sun sells can do this, I think. There's an open source one called Wagon. The catch with this is if you're just going to run the compile command elsewhere, then you need to make sure that it will generate the right results. You need to have the build directory probably NFS mounted so that every machine can see it at exactly the same path. If you install this and maybe you're running Debian unstable on the machines and one of the headers on one of them is just slightly different to the headers on the other, maybe you get a build error with version 1.0.2.3.4 and not with something else, then you get incredibly confusing error messages or errors, failures. So you need to make sure the machines are all in lockstep, and that's really too much hassle. Maybe I want to run unstable on one of them and not on the other. Maybe one of them is administered by my friend and I can run jobs, but I can't control what's going to happen there. So all of these are really too much hassle. To recap, we'd like to spread out the work so that it can complete faster, get the same output, get the same job more or less. It's important that the distributed build thing give you fairly reliably the same the same error messages and the same resulting program that you would get without it. Otherwise, any time that it saves you in building is going to be lost in wondering what went wrong or whether the problem is really in your code or in the build system. And I think we've got there more or less. You'd like it to be transparent to the user, so the error messages they see from the compiler, if they should be silly enough to have a bug in their program, are just what they would see regularly. And I wanted to make sure it was something that people install without a lot of hassle, without having to have root or install kernel patches or have machines go down all the time. Would be correct, yeah. So, a fellow in Germany, Eric Fee, I think, I can't remember his name, came up with this idea of compiler cache a while ago, which he wrote in Perl and which was eventually refined to Ckesh. And this is a little flowchart of compilation on Unix. Just slipped there. So you start with some source files, which are maybe assembler or C, and you run them through the preprocessor, which catches up the header files and so on, and then that goes into the compiler proper. You get some assembly code, and eventually some object code. Of course, all of this section is normally, not very visible to you. You just run CC, and it goes all the way from your source code through to an object file. Then all of your objects and some libraries get linked, and you get a program out at the end if you're lucky. So one interesting thing about this is that the compiler and assembler phase here takes a lot of the work of compilation, because it has to build a syntax tree of the program and reduce that to assembly and perhaps do some optimizations on it. And you might have a program like the Samba project, I think, has a few hundred source files, and it only ends up building a handful of programs. So there's relatively little work in linking. Most of it's in compilation. The other interesting thing this diagram points out is that this expensive phase that I've circled here basically only takes one input, which is the preprocessed source containing the results of digesting all the headers and so on, and it only produces one output. So in theory, you could lift that section up, put it on another machine on the network, and not have to worry too much about it accessing any other files or what headers are installed or anything like that. Any headers which are installed in the system get read in and dealt with by CPP here. What Ckesh does, I should say, is I don't know how many people, if anybody's used that. It's a pretty cool tool. It runs the C preprocessor to work out what the complete source for a particular source file is going to be, and uses that as a cache. So if the input to the compiler is the same and the compiler invocation options are the same, then we can know deterministically that the results of running the compiler is the same. So rather than running it, it just grabs it out of an on-disk cache and sticks it back in. So I think the thing Trigger originally wanted to use this for was a build farm, where we're repeatedly, just continuously all day, recompiling a source tree from CVS check-ins to make sure that nobody has built it. If you can start from an absolutely clean tree and do that all the way through, that gets you more reliable results. So, the implementation of DISCC is that it is a wrapper around GCC. So rather than calling GCC directly, you call either Ckesh or DISCC, and they kind of interpose themselves between your makefile or whatever it is that you're using and GCC. So they, first of all, look at the command line to work out what it is that you're asking GCC to do and whether it's something they can help with. If it's a task that isn't amenable to being moved across the network, maybe you're linking some object files, and that has to be done locally where it can get at your libraries, or maybe you're, checking GCC's version or something like that where it doesn't make sense to do it remotely. So they work that out. It runs the C preprocessor, which is the thing that handles the include lines and ifdef lines and so on. So that takes care of catching all of the header files that you have on your machine. DISCC uses a very simple custom network protocol that's designed to be very fast. All of this has to have a low overhead, otherwise, it would swallow any gains that you might get from moving it across the network. So it picks somewhere to run it, squirts it across the network, waits for that machine to finish, and then gets the response back and reinserts it into the build process. You might wonder at this point whether the time that it takes to move all of this data across the network and back and so on, surely that's going to take a long time. The pre-processed source can easily be a megabyte or more. So you think, come on, that's got to make it slower than doing it locally, surely, because we end up doing the same amount of work, but plus moving it across the network. But the key distinction here is that is between elapsed wall time and CPU time. Moving stuff across the network on Linux takes, you know, maybe takes a long time, especially if you're using, you know, wireless or something. But it doesn't take very much CPU time. Once we've built the result locally, it's basic. This uses the new SendFile API, so the kernel just gets network interrupts, feeds the network card, it goes across the network without very many CPU cycles at all being needed. And so while that particular file is being squirted across the network, both the local machine and the server are idle, and they can be, or nearly idle, they can be getting on with either building something locally or whatever. Before I wrote this, I wanted to make sure that it wasn't a wild goose chase, that it was actually going to have the potential to be a performance boost. And I think this is really something very good to do before you set out on an optimization or a performance improvement exercise. You want to try and do a really back of the envelope calculation to see if what you're attempting has any chance of success. So the measurement here is to see how much CPU time, how many CPU seconds will it take to run the preprocessor, and then how much will it take to, which is the part that we have to do locally, and then how much will it take in the part that we can distribute. So I measured that just using the Unix time command, and it turns out that the preprocess is very cheap. It's just text substitution, basically. It takes a hundredth of a second, maybe. The compiler, particularly if you're doing C++, which is more complicated, or if you're doing optimization, that might take a second per file on typical machines. So there is, you know, at first brush, you would think we can move maybe 90% of the work from this machine to that machine at reasonably low cost. I did some measurements of how much it cost to send it across the network, and this machine can get on with other stuff. Yeah. Right. So that's a good question. All of these numbers, any measurement about this is going to depend a lot on the particular source that you're building. So, for example, Samba has this technique of basically one big header file, which is included by everything. So there are not, every source file, and once it's preprocessed, ends up being enormous, whereas other programs are structured as, you know, smaller subsections with their own headers. Some programs have, you know, more knotty code, and the C++ is a big difference as well. The C++ preprocessor, I may be showing my ignorance here, but I think it basically only does what the C preprocessor does. It only does. Right. So yeah, we'd expect that the preprocessor will be about the same for both languages. The compiler is much harder to run in C++ than in C. Therefore, right. So you mean right. It's about the ratio rather than the absolute amount. I guess maybe what you're saying is that C++ programs include a lot of header files and a lot of complicated header files. Is that nested header files? Yeah, I guess That's probably true, but I think the ratio still remains the same or better because each of those headerfiles is probably declaring a class or whatever, and then that class definition has to be read and pondered by the compiler. So let me, if we have time, we might do some quick experiments. The main point I wanted to emphasize there is that lots of people, whether it's in the kernel scheduler or in CC or whatever, will say, I think it would be quicker if we did, you know, X, and that may or may not be true. But it's really good if you can think of a quick way to, you know, get a one-bit answer on, you know, is that actually going to work or not? Is there enough, you know, Amdahl's law where the if a particular part of the program is taking up 10% of the time, then the best you can possibly achieve is a 10% reduction by working on that area. So here we found out that the compiler rather than the preprocessor takes about 90% of the time. So that's really promising. We could get up to a 90%. So do some measurements first before you put a lot of time into writing it. It would be a shame to spend 6 months writing it and then go, oh, it doesn't work, hey, or it can't work. So as I said, I wanted to make sure it was something really quick and easy to install. So I think once you've read the manual, once you know how to use it, you can get it up and going in a minute or 2 minutes. Yesterday, Rasmus agreed to lend me his laptop to help out here, and I simply copied across the server binary, and we started it up with /dcd --daemon to get it going. The only real configuration item you need here is the name of the host that it's meant to run on. You just give it the IP address or the host name. Is that reasonably visible? Yeah. Just like this. It prefers the ones that come earlier in the string. It has a rough kind of balancing algorithm across them, but this means it's going to prefer this one, prefer his laptop if they're equally busy. Yeah, that's an interesting question. At the moment, it knows how many jobs this particular client has queued to run on each machine. That obviously doesn't take into account anything else that might be happening on those machines. It turns out to work reasonably well because context switch in a Linux is reasonably cheap, so running, if you run two jobs concurrently rather than two jobs one after the other, it only takes about the same amount of time. You don't lose from having a machine a bit overloaded. You do if it's starting to swap or thrash, but that's so a future work topic that I'll talk about later is how you can improve the schedule, perhaps. As a really simple example, I might just invoke it for a single file here. You can run this just like a C compiler, so DCC, compile, pretty easy, it's just like GCC, and I have a object file as the result of that. I might, it has a lot of debugging or tracing options, because I like that. You can see here it's kind of looking at what it is that it's meant to do, and it's worked out that it needs to call CC. That ought to be the output. Okay, and it's decided it's going to compile on Rasmus's machine. It's running the preprocessor. It's got a connection across there. It's sending all the stuff across. We sent, you know, hello world is pretty small, so we just sent a small file. And there we go, and it worked. So that's, you know, it's pretty simple. As a larger one, I have the Samba source here. It may take I don't know if we're going to have time during this to build the whole thing. I wonder. Why don't we try? In fact, another thing I've put into this is a a benchmarking suite, because it's, I wanted to be able to see, you know, for a realistic project, is this change that we're experimenting with going to make it faster or smaller? So again, you need to preferably base your optimization decisions in facts rather than surmises. So this thing knows how to build various interesting open source projects that, you know, I guess everyone has a different style of writing makefiles or a different coding style, so that they exercise it in different ways. If you have a very large project, it probably tests the system in ways that you might not think of by yourself. Sorry? Okay, I'm just going to make sure I got it here. Yeah, I don't have kernel 2.5. I might do GNU make. So I'm just going to tell it where I want it to build. So there's a little bit of intelligence in this. This was kind of inspired by the, you know, various auto builders that people have done for Debian or for Samba. So it has a little bit of or GNOME for that matter. It has a little bit of intelligence about how to build different things. That's a really good question. Do the versions of GCC have to match across different machines? GCC doesn't particularly care. It doesn't really make any difference. The question we really need to ask is, can you take object files from different versions of GCC and link them together and get what you want? And so in general, that's true. For C, that's true. But for C++, unfortunately, is AJ kind of shaking his head? For C++, they've gone through this binary interface transition, and so you cannot, in general, take a 3.2 C++ object file or library and link it with a 2.9.5.1 and have it work. So I may be wrong from the five hands that went up. Stephen? Really? Okay, well, that's pretty interesting. Huh. Okay, that's very interesting. And of course, you may get different, you know, some later GCCs have better warnings, so. Yeah, so it will actually. Yeah, so that's a good point. Okay, you need to not do that. I guess you can say, you know, GCC 3-2. I guess in the process of doing this, I've discovered some interesting GCC warts, and it's amazing how much the version number is not really a complete description of the version. So between, you know, Red Hat adds some patches, which can change the behavior of command line options and crazy stuff like that. Daniel? Yeah, it rocks. You need to just, of course, have installed a cross-compiler. That's your problem. I think Debian ships some cross-compilers today, so it takes a while. But the good thing is you have GCC to speed up building a cross-compiler. So a lot of the early interest in this was from the guys who do the N68K Linux port, and I think Linus was telling me the other day he sent the Atari maintainer a patch, and the guy basically said, okay, I'll get back to you in 2 days when I finish rebuilding. so they can, you know, work on that and build onto a. Yeah, you basically just need to use a. Well, look, so this finished. Here it gives you nice little tabulated results, and building on two machines took 11.7 seconds, and building on one machine took 21 seconds, so that's pretty cool. Those, I'll talk more about numbers that we see later on. You need to just invoke something. How does it go? Or, I don't know, how. And hello.c, and off you go. So it works well. The other guy who was very enthusiastic early on is some of the people who work on the Sharp Zaros, which is a Linux and Qt-powered PDA. So you can run a compiler, but it's not very fast. It's fast enough to run the preprocessor really quickly, kick the jobs off to your PC, and come back. And they reckon that absolutely rocks. So you can have a thing in your hand that builds programs at an equivalent speed of 1 gigahertz or so, which is pretty. I would like to benchmark this on the Bunyip supercomputer at ANU or the IBM P690, so you can sit with your laptop. And Anton's done a kernel build on that in 4 seconds. What's it? What? Sorry, 4.8 seconds to make 2420. So we need to sit there with your laptop and have to go bang. Sorry? A PowerPC. Was there somebody waiting over there? Yeah. Right. Yep. You merely do, you know. Well, in the simple case, we have a slow local host, and off you go. It will still have to run the linker and stuff like that here, but yep. I'm sorry, you need to speak up. Yeah. Yeah, you can do like you can do this, which will in the makefile set the default compiler to be disk.cc, or you can just override it when you run the makefile, even if it was configured with something else. one thing that being able to run, you know, many way parallelism points out is how much autoconf really sucks. You can't. It's written in shell, which is pretty slow, and it can't be parallelized. So, with several fast CPUs to run on, configure time can be slower than building. One of the more trivial test cases I do is build GNU Hello, which takes 20 seconds to configure, and you know, I guess it builds one source file at the end of all that. It's a bit funny. Brian. Right. Oh yeah. Okay. So, the word localhost is a magic word, which means just exec it directly. If maybe for testing you want to, you know, do it over the loopback, you say 127.0.0.1, which made sense to me. Where are we? This is basically the command I'm running. So I'm running disk.cc. I'm using disk.cc as the compiler name. You can also use it just as a prefix to the compiler, so you can say that. Some systems like this call it the slave, but I think it's more open sourcey to call it the volunteer. That's a nicer name. you run basically this command. You can run, it's, you know, a regular Unix daemon. You can run it from inetd or from, you know, just like this. And they don't need to know. You can, if you run it from inetd, you can put, you know, TCP wrappers around it. So you can see it's just started up here. It just listens and off it goes. You can set the port if you want. You can. No, it goes over TCP. It doesn't. I didn't see any reason to use UDP. Sorry? Yeah, people. In fact, this is another example of this thing about measuring before running away and spending 10 months coding. In fact, one of my professors at UQ said it's amazing how 4 weeks in the lab can avoid the need to spend an afternoon in the library. So, so I don't see any big reason to use CDP at the moment. Oh, it's pretty hard. very difficult. Oh yeah, sorry. I'm using the term inclusively here. I could. Yeah. So the GNU compiler collection. Yeah. I haven't tried Objective-C. I really don't know enough to know. Ada or Java have such a different approach to which files the compiler is going to run that. Yeah, it sends the command line across the. It would be interesting to do something like this for Java. It may be quite feasible to do it, but it would be. It would really have no code in common, I think. Yeah, you could do it for GCJ, but you know the class path stuff for Java. You'd have to basically start from scratch. But it would be a cool project if you built a lot of Java source. Yeah, they work that out. They only run the C preprocessor so once, and then CKH passes the preprocessor source to DCC, and DCC says, "Okay, that's preprocessed. I don't need to touch them." So an interesting future topic would be for a kind of distributed cache like Squid uses. So it would calculate the hash and then send maybe a UDP broadcast to every machine saying, "Does anybody have this? Anybody get this?" And then, if not, it actually builds it somewhere. I'll just maybe push through the rest of the slides so we get through that and then take some more questions. So 1.0 was released a little while ago. It works on lots of different things. Debian, I run SID, it works on that. It works on, I think it's in the Mandrake and Gentoo and SUSE distributions now, like the last SUSE CDs that came out had this. It's in FreeBSD, it works on Solaris, Zara, stuff like that. It's pretty portable. Oh, it works on Cygwin. So there's a project underway to make a little Windows installer that has a Linux cross-compiler and DCCD, so you install it on your friend's machine and their machine does it. So it does something useful in the future rather than just Solitaire. The goal for distributed computing is to be linearly scalable, so as you double the number of machines, you get twice as fast. That's the theoretical limit. DCC comes pretty close to that because it tries to have low overhead, but it varies depending on the project. So, for example, building Emacs is mostly spent compiling ELISP, and that is not amenable to this. I regularly build a whole lot of projects to check that I haven't broken anything that they depend upon. So it does all these guys here, at least. And there's, if you look on the web pages, there's some testimonials from people who use it to build their, you know, proprietary open source projects, and it works. There are GCC incompatibilities that you have to deal with, like I said. At the moment, it uses plain TCP sockets with no security measures, which is generally okay because most people have a network in their home which is firewalled and they can run whatever, or likewise for their office. I'd like to add SSH support in the future so you can run it just over random networks. I'll take questions when I finish this, if you don't mind. The other thing is, it does tend to find makefile bugs because most people don't. I guess lots of people use make-j now, but they don't have enough CPUs that it can be very, very parallel. So if you have makefiles which don't specify dependencies that ought to be there, then it will kind of, you know, a file won't exist when it expected it to. But generally, that's straightforward to fix. As I said, it's not. It doesn't always go as fast as it doesn't always reach the theoretical limit. Sometimes this is because there are non-parallelizable tasks like linking. So I think on kernel compile wars, the dominant task is now linking, isn't it? Because you can't parallelize it. Ooh, a parallel linker might be an interesting thesis topic or something. Or if you're building documentation or Lisp or whatever, that obviously can't be spread out. The second, probably less than that, is that sometimes the scheduler will leave a machine idle when it ought to do something on that. It's kind of comparable to the kernel scheduler, perhaps. Not as complex, but the problem essentially is you don't know what jobs make is going to ask you to do in the future, so you have to make decisions now based on the information available, which is not not always sufficient to get an optimal spread. So you may, for example, right as you come to the end of the program that you're trying to build, you might have in the past decided to put three jobs here, and now this machine is finished, there's some more jobs to put on it, and you just have to wait for it to finish. Network overhead is a little, it's not very big. It could be more efficient on slow networks. I'll be working on that. CPU overhead is really very tiny. There are two test suites. When does this finish? Quarter two? Is it 5 minutes? So there are two test suites for it. There is like a micro test suite, which is kind of like clear box testing. It knows about particular bits of the code, so it exhaustively tests the code that tries to understand GCC command lines by feeding it intentionally weird command lines. And then there is a macro benchmark, which is the one I was using before, which knows how to build large open source trees, so that measures overall performance and so on. Testability is really interesting because if you have this complex program and you sit down and think, how am I going to test that? It's, you know, you don't know where to begin, but I really encourage people to kind of stick at it because as you get into it and move along, you think of new things that you can test and then you find bugs and it goes well. So what else? There are some interesting parts there, but I'll skip just for now. Testing distributed systems is kind of interesting. What? Pizza? Okay. So what else? I want to let it run over SSH. That would be neat. We can do network. We can do a very gentle compression of network traffic to, you know, not waste too many CPU cycles, but make it run better across slow networks. GCC has some incredibly weird, I guess, where they shipped with bugs, and then they realized and it was already documented, so it had to be a feature. So they've changed, like the behavior of Dash O has changed enormously. You would think it was well-defined, but it's not. There's this idea that you might go into a like geek meeting and discover how many machines want to volunteer for this. Yeah, so you can do zero conf for SLP or something. So it's interesting. I'm not entirely convinced that it's a good idea because you want to have an informed decision about GCC versions and stuff like that, and that might be pretty confusing if you just compile on weird machines. Obviously, you need to trust the machines that you're compiling onto because they can send you, you know, arbitrary object code back that's not checked. More testing? Any questions? Okay, so, cool. I really encourage you to all download it. It's very, you can apt-get install GCC and off you go. Yeah, gentleman in the orange shirt there. Yeah, the question was failure recovery. So it tries to do a good job without getting too complicated. So if a machine that you expected to be there was down, or if it drops the connection while you're trying to send it, then it will say, okay, well, I'll try it locally, and it sends out a warning. It doesn't try to completely hide it, because if the machine is down, then you probably, you know, you may want to know about that and fix it. Yeah, I was thinking about that tonight. It tries fairly hard to never give you a wrong object file. It should either, depending on exactly how it fails, build it locally or stop with an error. So either one of, and if it stops with an error, you just fix the problem and type make again. So yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. If the machine disappears when it's right. So if a machine, if you are building and you suddenly pull the network cable out of a machine, then it may, the overall compile may fail, and I kind of think that's a reasonable behavior. If you do service to CCD stop, then it will go down gently, which I think is also reasonable. If you bring up a machine that was listed but not up and it starts using it, then everything will be fine. I think that's a real strength of this compared to something like OpenMosix, where it's done at the kernel level. And as far as I know, if you power off a machine, then you know, randomly weird things happen in the remainder of the cluster. Is that? Maybe. Who's? Yeah. Sorry. Can you be quiet so I can hear this gentleman? Oh yeah. Yeah. That's. Okay, so the question was, what happens, will it remember if a machine's timed out, or will it cope if a machine? Oh, yeah, let me unplug, well, I won't demo it, but yeah, it does cope with that. It could be a bit smarter about remembering, okay, the last 200 times I tried to use this machine, it didn't work, so maybe I should forget about it. But at the moment, you'll just get 200 errors, and again, that's kind of reasonable. Like, maybe the operator wants to work out what's wrong and fix it. So, you've had one. The gentleman in the blue shirt. Just wondering,
what's the protocol waiting for, say, clean fire off a compiler on the blockchain?
Right.
Does the network protocol wait for the compiler to finish
before sending the next file on? Yeah, the thing is that make invokes every compiler as a separate process. So each individual process opens its connection and sends stuff across, and then waits, and then gets it back. Right. Right. Yeah, actually, one thing I'm planning to do is make them coordinate their usage of the network so that not everybody kind of tries to get through the fire door at the same time. But it's a testament to TCP/IP and the Linux scheduler that you can just, you know, more or less flail away at, and then it'll cope. I can't hear what you're saying, sorry. Right. Oh, yeah, so it does do that. You typically use a -j value, which is higher than the number of machines, so that it allows for some files to be in transit across the network, and you really want to avoid any of the machines sitting idle waiting for something to come through. So it does a reasonable job. It could be a bit fine-tuned. You got to finish? Okay. Well, I'll be around. I hope you all, you know, download it and try it out.